Right, I'm going to start by giving you another piece of paper, which is my Bible time chart, which might just help us to see where we've got to and where we're going in our Bible overview. Okay, so so if you were here 2 weeks ago, you remember that we began in Eden. We began with creation, and we saw the pattern of the kingdom. So if the kingdom of God is God's people in God's place under God's rule, who were God's people at the start? Adam and Eve. Where was God's place?
Eden.
And what was the rule?
God's commands.
Particular command? To not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And as they lived in the garden, under God's rule, as God's people, they enjoyed God's blessing, the blessing of life, and were able to fulfill God's purpose. Then we saw the rejection of the kingdom, the fall, the rule of God is rejected, they are exiled from the garden. Then we sort of follow through the events of Noah and the flood and then Babel. And that's all in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And then we come to the sort of the true turning point with Abraham and the promises to Abraham. We'll come back to those in a moment. Then we go through Abraham's son Isaac. Then Isaac has Esau and Jacob, but Jacob is the chosen one, name changed to Israel. 12 sons, one of whom is Joseph, ends up in Egypt, and through Joseph the whole family ends up in Egypt. So then we, on our timeline there, we get to the red bit, Israel in Egypt for 400 plus years, until the time of Moses. Moses leads them out of Egypt at the time of the plagues and so on, into the wilderness to Sinai to receive the law. They could have gone into the promised land with another couple of years of leaving Egypt. They were 1 year at Sinai, then they march on to the promised land, but then there's rebellion at the promised land, so there's a sort of 40 wasted years wandering around the wilderness, and then under Joshua into the promised land, into the period of the judges, much rebellion against the rule of God during that period, repeated cycles of rebellion and judgment and grace and rescue, as God rescued them time and time again through different judges, until we come into the time of Samuel and the book of 1 Samuel, when the people demand a king, and so he gives them a king like they want, the sort of king they're asking for, like the other nations, a big person to lead them in battle. He gives them Saul, who's a head and shoulders taller than anybody else in Israel. But Saul disobeys God. Saul is rejected as king. And we're on to the bottom half of the timeline. So God seeks out a man after his own heart to be king in Saul's place. That's David. And through David, victories are won. Peace is established. And promises are made to David that a son of David will reign on David's throne forever and ever. And of course, the first fulfillment of that is Solomon, David's son, becomes king after him. David's dynasty is established. And what does Solomon build? The temple. So he's the one who builds the temple. And the glory of God comes and fills the temple. And Solomon is not only the temple builder, Solomon is wealthy and he's wise. And who comes to visit? The Queen of Sheba, representative of the nations. So now the nations begin to sit up and take notice, and she's has heard reports of Solomon's wisdom and his wealth, that when she comes and sees it for herself and hears for herself, she's overwhelmed. And so we come to what I said was the high point in the history of Israel. What chapter of the Bible are we in as we sort of come to that high point? Do you remember? We're in Kings. Which chapter of Kings? So 1 Kings chapter 10. So basically, when if you put your finger on 1 Kings 10 in the Old Testament, That's as sort of as good as it gets. Really, that whole section from chapter 4 to chapter 10, but that's as good as it gets in the Old Testament. And it's downhill from there. And what we're going to see, we're going to follow through the rest of the history in the Old Testament this evening. And just to sort of help us not lose our way, see where it's going, you'll see on that timeline, what happens after Solomon is you then get the division of the kingdom. So we've now got two tracks. We've got Israel in the north, we've got Judah in the south. Lots of kings in Israel, lots of kings in Judah that follow in succession. But rebellion against God's rule and exile in the end for both kingdoms. First for Israel under the Assyrians. So that purple period, that's a period of Assyrian dominance. So that's when the kingdom of Israel ends. Judah lasts another couple of hundred years or so. But in the end, that comes to an end with the Babylonians and the fall of Jerusalem and the exile into Babylon. But we can now speak of the Jews, the people of Judah, taken into exile, and the Jews come out of exile at the end of the Babylonian period, at the beginning of the Persian Empire, and we have the return from exile that we'll come to this evening. And then that we're sort of just pretty much at the end of the Old Testament there, then the long period of waiting through the demise of the Persian Empire, the rise of the Greek Empire, into the Roman period, until Christ comes. And so that chart gives you that's sort of the Bible in outline. That gives you some dates, so you can see where you are. And also on there you'll see it shows you sort of where the different Bible books fit in to that timeline. So helpful. I hope that's helpful to sort of not get sort of lost in the detail. So, going on to your blue handout. Where did we get to last time? Well, we saw how the promises to Abraham were fulfilled. That essentially the promise to Abraham was a promise of the kingdom. And it's fulfilled in what we might call the partial kingdom. It's not the final fulfillment, but it's fulfilled partially under Solomon. So now, by the time we get to Solomon and that section from 2 Kings 4 to 10, we have, who are God's people? It's the nation of Israel. And they're exceedingly numerous, so that promise of many offspring has been fulfilled. They're in God's place, the promised land, and the focal point of God's presence amongst them is in Jerusalem, also called Zion, and with the temple in Jerusalem where the presence of God is to be found. So they're God's people in God's place, with God living among them. And as far as God's rule is concerned, they have the law of Moses and they have the wise King Solomon ruling over them in the line of David. And they're enjoying God's blessing in terms of peace and security and prosperity. And as I said, the nations beginning to take notice. Queen of Sheba visits. And Solomon's prayer for the temple is that the temple will be a house of prayer for all nations. And if those from the nations turn towards this temple and they pray to the Lord of this temple, to Yahweh, he prays that the Lord would hear their prayers. So we seem all set for God's purpose of Israel to be his vehicle of blessing to the nations to be fulfilled. Only it's not quite so easy. And so what we're turning to this evening is the story of decline and fall. But let's just, before we come to that, just to wind back a bit. Something I sort of glossed over the last week was sort of David's big black mark. David's adultery. His adultery with Bathsheba. And it's not just that he sleeps with another man's wife, commits adultery, but then when he discovers that she's been made pregnant by that, well, he has her husband Uriah killed in an attempt to cover things up. And in the process, many innocent people are killed. Those events all recorded in 2 Samuel 11. But you might say, well, if the Bible writers want to present us with sort of David, the ideal king, then why include such a sordid story? And I take it one reason for doing so is to show us that even the greatest of human kings is flawed. So David has been described as a man after God's own heart, and yet even David fails to live under God's rule and breaks the commandments of God in the most serious fashion. And if David himself could not live under God's rule, well, how could he bring the people of God under the rule of God? And in fact, the rest of 2 Samuel really is a turgid tale of incest and conspiracy in David's own family, which spreads to civil war in the nation. And so if the kingdom of God means God's people living in God's place under God's rule, then David is actually the biggest indicator yet that no ordinary human king will ever establish the kingdom. And yet, the promise remains that a son of David will reign on David's throne forever. Even though you get those promises of David, the king on his throne forever, in 2 Samuel 7, and in 2 Samuel 11 he's committing adultery. But the promise is not withdrawn. But how will it be fulfilled? And in a way, David's physical adultery leads us to Solomon's spiritual adultery. So do turn to 1 Kings chapter 11. So if 1 Kings 10 is the high point, then chapter 11 must be the chapter where things take the downward turn. And after the bright start with Solomon, we might hope for better things, but again, we're disappointed. Yeah, sure, the start of Solomon's reign is glorious. He's wealthy, he's wise, he builds the glorious temple for God in Jerusalem. But his downfall comes through his love for foreign women. Intermarriage with the women of the foreign nations was forbidden by God's law, forbidden for the Israelites. But Solomon had 700, it's staggering. Every time you read this, this is staggering, isn't it? That Solomon had 700 foreign wives and 300 concubines. I mean, this is, it's partly love and lust, but it's partly politics. It's partly forming alliances through marriage. Well, you know, I mean, I guess once you've got through got the first 20 or 30 wives, then, you know, what's another one? Another one, another one, to make another alliance, and another alliance.
What's the difference between a wife and a concubine in this sort of, you know?
There was a difference in status that I suppose that the offspring of wives were potential legitimate heirs. Yeah. Although, you know, who's... There's going to be lots of competition there, isn't there, with 700, with the status of wife. So, whereas a concubine is more like a kept mistress, and there's no legitimacy to the offspring, I guess, is probably one of the key things.
It just seems so strange.
Yeah,
You've got 700 wives, why not the other 300?
Yes, wives? Yeah. I mean, it could well have been that the 700 were the women he married for political reasons, and the 300 were the ones he fancied.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
a lot of weddings. A lot of things. Just imagine the wedding planning. Anyway, let's not get too stalled on that. But the issue is not just all these marriages. The issue is the impact and on his heart. And as God's word predicted, these women turned Solomon away from his devotion to the Lord, and he started to worship other gods. So you see in chapter 11, verse 5, that he followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. Detestable because child sacrifice was part of the worship of Molech. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord, He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. And we read about the consequences of this in verses 9 to 13. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." So as a judgment for Solomon's spiritual adultery, God will take most of the kingdom away from his son. And after Solomon's death, the kingdom is divided, as most of the 12 tribes rebel against Solomon's son, Rehoboam, and say, we're not going to have Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, as our king. And they choose to follow a guy called Jeroboam instead. And only Judah, the southern tribe, and sort of the rump tribe of Benjamin recognized Solomon's son as Rehoboam. And we have the 10 tribes in the north. So we get this, you've got a, towards the back of the hand, your handout, you've got a map just to show you the division of the kingdom. It's not quite right, this, but okay, so essentially the kingdom divides so that you have the northern kingdom up here, southern kingdom here. The southern kingdom from this point is named after the tribe of Judah, the dominant tribe in the south, and the capital is Jerusalem. So there's Jerusalem. Should be slightly further north, I think. But Jerusalem. Here, the capital. So you've got Judah in the south, so there's your southern kingdom, Judah. And the northern kingdom still gets called Israel, with the 10 tribes. And the capital of Israel is Samaria. Okay, so from this point on, we're going to be reading actually about the history of two nations, of Judah and Israel. Sometimes at war with each other, often hostility, occasional alliances between them. And so the way that the Book of Kings now works is that the spotlight will sort of keep shifting from the north to the south, to the north to the south, and so on. So essentially sort of what happens is if you have someone becomes king in Judah, you'll then get... So let me just check, remind myself how this works. So what sort of once one king in one territory has been named, then you'll sort of get all the other people who become king in the other territory join the reign of that king. So say you start with the king of Judah, you'll then follow all the kings in Israel who become king, join the reign of that king until this king is dead. Yes, and then you'll switch to following, well, what happened after this king here, and so on. Okay, so you sort of follow some of the kings in Israel for a period, and then you'll suddenly switch over and you'll be following some of the kings of Judah, depending on how the reigns overlap. Don't worry about that, but we do just have to keep our sort of on our toes as to, is it talking about the north or is it talking about the south as we go through the account. Well, let's follow, but for make it slightly easier for ourselves, let's just focus on Israel first of all, and then we will focus on Judah. So Israel, the northern kingdom, is the kingdom that has, remember, rejected the Davidic kingship So it's Rehoboam, son of Solomon, descended from David, and it's his descendants, his heirs and successors, who reign in Jerusalem. So the northern kings have rejected the Davidic king. And they have all sorts of kings from different families and dynasties. So if you look at... Now, I'll tell you what, I'll come back to that later. I'll come back to that later. Okay. And they're ruled over, sort of in the north, different families, different dynasties, over a period of about 200 years, with lots of various coups and assassinations. So one family might reign for two or three generations, and then somebody bumps off the king and kills the whole of that family, or any potential rivals, and establishes their family as holding the monarchy. And they might hold on to it for a generation or two, and then the same thing happens to them. But in terms of obedience to God, things get off to a pretty bad start. Because when Jeroboam becomes king, his great fear is that, well, where will people go to worship? Jerusalem. Why? That's where the temple is. So if his citizens of his kingdom, his subjects, if they head off to Jerusalem in the other kingdom to worship, what might they do? Follow the king in the south, Rehoboam. So he has a great idea that he will set up shrines, one shrine down here in the south at Bethel, and one shrine right up here in the north at the other end of his territory at Dan. And there he erects golden calves. And he says to the people, well, these golden calves, these are the gods that led you out of Egypt. And so this is where you can worship the God who led you out of Egypt, by bowing down and worshipping these golden calves at Bethel and Dan. Well, almost at once, an unnamed man of God, an unnamed prophet, turns up at Bethel and announces God's judgment against the shrine. But from here on, Israel is going to be plagued by that sort of idolatry. And in fact, worse, by mixing pagan Canaanite religion with the worship of Yahweh. And from this point on, the comment that will often be made about kings in the north, in Israel, is that they continued in the sin of Jeroboam. And when you read about the sin of Jeroboam, it's this particular sin of setting up these shrines, and he establishes a priesthood to go with them and so on, this whole idolatrous system of worship established in the north, that's what they continue in. But things get even worse than that in the time of wicked King Ahab. So if we turn to 1 Kings chapter 16, so we can't do all the history, all the ups and downs, all the kings, all the things that happened, there are far too many things. So I'm just doing some of the highlights, which really turn out to be lowlights in this case. So 1 Kings 16 and verse 29. Okay, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it a trivial thing to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, the worship of the golden calves, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, which is sort of from just north of Israel, just up here, Tyre and Sidon, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did all the kings of Israel before him. So, not only have we got the idolatry of sort of pretending that you can worship Yahweh by bowing down to these golden calves. But now we've got the wholesale importation of Canaanite religion, the worship of Baal. Baal was a Canaanite storm god, and Asherah was his female consort, a goddess of fertility. And the influence of Ahab's marriage to Jezebel is to bring Baal worship right into the heart of Israel, and in fact to make the worship of Baal the state religion of the nation. And it's during the reign of Ahab that God sends Elijah, and then Elijah is succeeded by Elisha, prophets, to call Israel back to obedience to the word of God. And in 2 Kings chapter 8, Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal to a contest. So if we just look at 2 Kings chapter, sorry, did I say 8? 18, I meant. And I meant 1 Kings. Okay, so scrub that. 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 22. There's a big assembly of the prophets at Baal at Mount Carmel. So now we are sort of up here. Here's Mount Carmel. It's on your map. Okay. So we've got all the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel. And we've got Elijah, who stands for the worship of Yahweh. And Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal to a contest. So he says, look at verse 22. He said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood." So they built an altar with some wood, but not to set fire to it. "I will prepare the other bull and put it on another altar with the wood there, but not set fire to it." Okay, so now we've got two altars, got two bulls cut up into pieces, lying there on the wood on the altar. And then he says, verse 24, "Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of Yahweh the Lord, the God who answers by fire. He is God." So you see? So let's set this thing up, and let's settle this once and for all. Who is the real God? Is it Yahweh or is it Baal? And he says, you can go first, you prophets of Baal. So they cry out to Baal, and they do all the things that they do to get Baal's attention, and they even cut themselves so the blood flows, because that's one way that they get the attentions of the gods. And Elijah mocks them, you know, saying, "Well, perhaps he's asleep. So perhaps you need to shout louder to wake him up, or perhaps he's." And it says in the text, they continued their frantic prophesying all through the day to the time of the evening sacrifice. But there was no answer. And then Elijah, if we're looking at verse 32, he built an altar in the name of Yahweh, and he dug a trench around it large enough to hold two seers of seed. He arranged wood, he cut the bull into pieces and laid it on the wood. And then he said, "Fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered, and they did it the third time. The water ran around the altar and even filled the trench. So you see what he's saying? So, drenching the whole thing with water, the whole thing surrounded by a trench filled with water, so they can have the, you know, no one, if this thing sets on fire, no one can say, "Well, there was a sort of spark in these dry conditions." And then Elijah prays, verse 37, "Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." Then, you see, verse 38, "The fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, 'The Lord, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God.'" And then Elijah commanded them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away." They seized them. And Elisha had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. Well, we can't follow the story, but it's a great demonstration as to who is really God. Yahweh is God, the God of Elijah, not Baal. Yahweh wins the contest. But actually, sadly, nothing really changes in Israel. Not even after the death of Ahab. So look at 1 Kings 22, for instance. 1 Kings 22 and verse 51. Ahaziah, son of Ahab, became king of Israel in Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord because he followed the ways of his father and mother, that's Ahab and Jezebel, and of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. He served and worshipped Baal and aroused the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, just as his father had done. Tragic, really, isn't it? After Elijah and Elisha and all they had done to show that Yahweh was the true God. Nothing really changes. The idolatry, the worship of false gods continues. And later on in the north, the prophets Amos and Hosea are raised up by God, and they warn the nation that the final judgment will come if they do not repent. But Israel wouldn't listen, and the Assyrians come, and in 722 the Assyrians sack the city of Samaria and take the Israelites into exile. But it's a sort of scattering, really, of the Israelites throughout various locations in the Assyrian Empire. There is another map in your handout which shows you where the extent of the Assyrian Empire from its so it's on the penultimate page. From its heartland there, the area sort of in purple, how it spread to fill the whole area covered in green. So, well, since it's green on there, let's do this. So Israel gets absorbed into this great Assyrian Empire. And we read all about it in 2 Kings chapter 17. So let's jump on to that. And 2 Kings, so again, a sort of important chapters in the Bible. 2 Kings 17 is one of those important chapters because it records for us the reasons for the exile and the end of the northern kingdom. So the start of the chapter tells us about Hoshea, the last king of Israel, and how in verse 5 the king of Assyria invaded the entire land, marched against Samaria, laid siege to it for 3 years. And in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria and settled them in those various places. Then verse 7, all this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations that the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices that the kings of Israel had introduced. The Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places. Those are high places of worship in all their towns. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. At every high place they burned incense, as the nations whom the Lord had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things that aroused the Lord's anger. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had said, "You shall not do this." The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and seers, "Turn from your evil ways, observe my commands and decrees, in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your ancestors to obey, and that I delivered to you through my servants the prophets." But they would not listen, and were as stiff-necked as their ancestors who did not trust in the Lord their God. They rejected his decrees, and the covenant he made with their ancestors, and the statutes he'd warned them to keep. They followed worthless idols. and themselves became worthless. They imitated the nations around them that the Lord had ordered them, do not do as they do. They forsook all the commands of the Lord their God and made themselves two idols cast in the shape of calves and an Asherah pole. They bowed down to all the starry hosts and they worshipped Baal. They sacrificed their sons and daughters in the fire. They practiced divination and sought omens and sold themselves to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was left. Notice that the exile is, so we have all the reasons to do it, and we have their stubborn refusal to listen to the prophets, their persistence in idolatry and disobedience and breaking the commands, their faithlessness. Finally, they are removed from the land, but notice it's how it's described, they are removed from his presence. So that the land is the land where they were able to enjoy the presence of God, but they are exiled from his presence. In other words, it's like the Garden of Eden again, replayed in extreme slow motion over centuries. So you'd had God's people, Adam and Eve, living in the garden, which was the garden of God's presence, it's the garden where God walked in the cool of the day. There they were, privileged to live in that place, in fellowship with God. They reject God's rule, and they are exiled from that place of God's presence, the sanctuary of the garden. And then you see God then brings Israel into the land of his presence, where he will dwell with them. But they persist in rebellion over the centuries, and finally his patience comes to an end and he casts them out from his presence. It's Eden all over again, played out in slow motion. Well, is it any better? That's the north. You reckon it's any better in the south? Not a lot. Not a lot. In the end, things in Judah turn out just as bad. Actually, you see it here, don't you? In 2 Kings 17. So if I'd read on from verse 18, you see how it says, verse 18, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was left. And verse 19, even Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God. They followed the practices Israel had introduced. Therefore the Lord rejected all the people of Israel, afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers until he thrust them from his presence. Got a little anticipation that it's going to end the same way for Judah, because they follow the pattern of Israel. And most of the kings of Judah were a bad lot. But God is faithful to his word. And God, in particular, is faithful to his promise to David. And so the line of David continues as son succeeds father for 400 years. See, for example, let's just go 2 Kings chapter 8. So just look 2 Kings 8, verse 16. So we're jumping back to just after Ahab in the north. In the fifth year of Joram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, when Jehoshaphat was king of Judah, Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, began his reign as king of Judah. Just to point out there, what you've got there is actually what they call a co-regency. Do you realize it's saying that Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, begins his reign while his father Jehoshaphat is still alive? So it is one way to secure the succession was the son to start operating as king before the father dies, so that his sort of throne is established, and you have this sort of co-regency, this overlapping of father and son both reigning at the same time. But notice what we learn about Jehoram in verse 18. That he followed the ways of the kings of Israel in the north, although he's a king in the south, as the house of Ahab had done. Why? For he married a daughter of Ahab. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Nevertheless, for the sake of his servant David, the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah. He had promised to maintain a lamp for David and his descendants forever. So even though there are kings in the south who are doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, the kingdom is still not taken away from David's family, because David, God had made his promise to David. So when it says, it keeps saying, for the sake of his servant David, it means because of the covenant promises that God had made to David. That God will be true to his word. God will keep his promise. God will be faithful to his promise even when the people keep on being unfaithful. Which explains the chart that you've got on the penultimate page of your handout. That one, see that one that says the kings of Israel and Judah. Where's that nice music coming from? So what do you see with Israel? Those different colours, they represent different families or dynasties that generally, well, or frequently, only last for a short time. So Jeroboam is succeeded by his son Nadab. But what do you think the sort of the skull and crossbones next to Nadab means? He gets killed. So he gets killed by Baasha, who reigns for a while, who's succeeded by Elah. And then look what happens to Elah. He gets killed by Zimri. And Zimri gets bumped off. And then you have Omri. And the house of Omri reigns for a while with Ahab, is Omri's son. So you've got all these different dynasties. But what have you got on the other side, apart from one exception that we'll come to? We've got the one colour, the blue, which is the house of David for 450 years. Which is remarkable when you think about it. I mean, think about British history. How many different houses have we had? The house of Tudor, the house of George, the Georges, and, you know, different. Stuarts. Hanover, that's the word I'm looking for. House of George. That's your house. The House of Hanover, the Stuarts, the Plantagenets, etc. But God is being faithful to his promise. It's always a son of David. What's that little exception bit, that funny green bit, what's that doing in the history of Judah? Well, that's all to do with a woman called Athaliah, which is this daughter of Ahab that Jehoram marries. And she is a particularly nasty piece of work. Turn to 2 Kings 11. So, Jehoram had married Athaliah, this daughter of wicked King Ahab, and her mother was Jezebel. And they have a son, Ahaziah, who duly becomes king after the death of his father. But what happens when her son Ahaziah dies? Look at 11:1. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she proceeded to destroy the whole royal family. That means killing her grandchildren and her nephews and her nieces and anybody who is related by blood to the house of David. She is, I think we can in this case say, hell-bent on destroying the house of David. You see? But, you see, verse 2, Jehosheba, the daughter of King Jehoram and sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the royal princes who were about to be murdered. She put him and his nurse in a bedroom to hide him from Athaliah, so he was not killed. He remained hidden with his nurse, so he's still suckling milk, at the temple of the Lord for 6 years while Athaliah ruled the land. So she tries to wipe out the whole house of David so that she can have the throne for herself. But see how the Lord works to preserve the line of David. that the baby, Joash, is hidden away and protected. And in the 7th year, 6 years later, Jehoiada, who is the priest, manages to overthrow Ataliah, bring out Joash, and put Joash on the throne. Sorry? Jehoiada, so you see in verse 4, you'll see him in the 7th year, Jehoiada sent for the commanders of units of hundreds, the Karaites, the guards, and so on, and it basically organises this sort of coup against Ataliah and has her overthrown. And she is killed, and Joash is restored to the throne. So there is this moment in Judah's history where the house of David has become one baby, hidden away. But God preserves the line of David, and Joash does take the throne. And Joash turns out to be a rather good king, who repairs the temple of the Lord, which has fallen into terrible disrepair and disuse, whilst other gods have been worshipped. And there are some other good kings, like Hezekiah and Josiah. Look at the commendation of Hezekiah in 2 Kings chapter 18. So 2 Kings 18, verse 3. It's nice to read, isn't it, about Hezekiah? That he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. He held fast to the Lord and did not stop following him. He kept the commands the Lord had given him, and the Lord was with him. He was successful in whatever he undertook. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. From watchtower to fortified city, he defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory. And so Hezekiah is the king in Judah at the time when the northern kingdom falls to the Assyrians. And indeed the Assyrians, they go on to invade Judah and to attack the fortified cities of Judah. And you can go to the British Museum and you can see this great room full of these stone relief carvings where the Assyrians from one of their palaces have depicted the siege of Lachish, one of the fortified towns. And they go on to besiege Jerusalem. So the northern kingdom is gone. The armies of Assyria have filled the southern kingdom. They're besieging Jerusalem. And Hezekiah puts his trust in the Lord. He's been wavering, but at this point he finally puts his trust in the Lord, and in answer to prayer, the Lord miraculously delivers the city from the Assyrians. And the remarkable thing, and the king of his army is put to death, and the king of Assyria withdraws. And the remarkable thing is that there are these stone reliefs that celebrate the siege and the defeat of Lachish, but there's nothing in all that Assyrian stuff to celebrate the fall of Jerusalem, because it didn't fall, just as the biblical account tells us. We were looking at this stuff the beginning of September with our elders and staff going to tour the British Museum. And our tour guide said, well, so, you know, it's a bit like having all these things celebrating the fall of Reading. Yeah, okay, but what about London? If you're celebrating the fall of Reading, it means you didn't take London. They didn't take Jerusalem. So there's an artifact where Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, he boasts that he had Hezekiah like a caged bird in Jerusalem. But that's as far as it got. He didn't take the city. God preserves them. So it's a wonderful story there in Kings, also told in Isaiah who was prophet at the time. But tragically, Hezekiah's son, Manasseh, was one of the worst kings. He's a terrible king. So just jump on to chapter 21. And look at Manasseh's reign. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 55 years. It's a long reign. His mother's name was Hephzibah. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, following the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He rebuilt the high places his father Hezekiah had destroyed. He also erected altars to Baal and made an Asherah pole, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. He bowed down to all the starry hosts and worshipped them. He built altars in the temple of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem I will put my name." In the two courts of the temple of the Lord, he built altars to all the starry hosts. He sacrificed his own son in the fire, practiced divination, sought omens, and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger. He took the carved Asherah pole he'd made and put it in the temple of which the Lord had said to David and to his son Solomon, "In this temple and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever." So he even sets up shrines for articles, items for pagan worship, right in the middle of the temple of the Lord, after the fine example of his father Hezekiah. A complete turn back in the wrong direction. And alongside that, you see verse 16. "Moreover, Manasseh also shed so much innocent blood that he filled Jerusalem from end to end, beside the sin that he'd caused Judah to commit, so that they did evil in the eyes of the Lord." Presumably, much of that innocent blood was those who stood for the worship of Yahweh and resisted this pagan turn of Manasseh. And with the exception of Josiah, the kings that follow are no better. They all do evil in the eyes of the Lord. And there are more prophets at this time, people like Isaiah and Micah and Zephaniah and Joel and Jeremiah, over a couple of centuries. And they all warn Judah that judgment is coming. Isaiah is a prophet at the time when the Assyrians are taking the north, and he warns that if there is no repentance, the same thing that happened in the north will happen in the south. But kings and nation persist in rebelling against God's rule, and eventually in 586 BC Jerusalem is sacked by the Babylonians. So that by this point that the Babylonians have overthrown the Assyrian Empire, so the superpower is no longer the Assyrians, the superpower is Babylon, and they come and they besiege the city, and the city falls this time, and the temple is burnt, and the remnant of the nation is taken into exile in Babylon. And let's just jump to the very end of 2 Kings, 2 Kings 25. There you can read all about the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem and how the city fell, and you see what happens to the king in verse 7. "They killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes," the king. "Then they put out his eyes, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. And on the seventh day of the fifth month, in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, commander of the imperial guard, an official of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He set fire to the temple of the Lord, the royal palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down. And the whole Babylonian army, under the command of the imperial guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. And Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, carried into exile the people who remained in the city, along with the rest of the populace and those who had deserted to the king of Babylon." and all the articles from the temple are taken off to Babylon.
So does that mean that area would then be covered in green?
Yeah, so it's essentially, yeah. No, it was part of, so Jerusalem, so more or less, yeah, you're right, sort of more or less, so the Babylonians had really taken over that area in green, had taken the Assyrian Empire, and now it extends down to swallow up Judah as well. When the Assyrians took the northern kingdom, then they moved the Israelites out and they brought other peoples in from elsewhere. And those are the ancestors of the Samaritans at the time of Jesus. No doubt there was some occupation after Judah fell and the Jews were taken off into exile. No doubt there was some occupation of this territory, but Jerusalem remains a ruined city. It's not rebuilt until the Jews come back. Yeah. So it's not occupied by other people. So it would seem, wouldn't it, that it would seem the kingdom is no more. It's all over. It's all been wiped out. You no longer have God's people in God's place, under God's rule. There's no Davidic king to rule over them. But the hope of God's kingdom is not lost. And 2 Kings 25 actually ends with the Davidic line preserved. So you see, very end of the book, verse 27, in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. So the Zedekiah we had mentioned was actually Jehoiakim's uncle, but Jehoiakim himself had been taken into exile in Babylon earlier. And in the 37th year of his exile, in the year Arul-Marduk became king of Babylon, he released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. He did this on the 27th day of the 12th month. He spoke kindly to him and gave him a seat of honor higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiakim put aside his prison clothes and for the rest of his life ate regularly at the king's table. Day by day, the king gave Jehoiakim a regular allowance as long as he lived. So you get this little upturn. What's the point? The Davidic line is preserved. There is still a son of David, even in captivity in Babylon, who's alive and now actually released from imprisonment to dine at the king of Babylon's table. There's hope there, and the hope of God's kingdom is kept alive in the words of the prophets that we will look at next week. But to sum up what the prophets say, well, what the prophets promise is restoration. The restoration of the kingdom. And so in terms of the history, we come to the very end of the Old Testament. The final phase is the restoration. And now it's the history recounted in Ezra and Nehemiah. The book of Esther also belongs to this period. And the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi. Because what happens is in 539 BC, the armies of Cyrus, king of the Medes and the Persians, captures the city of Babylon. So if you're on the map, if you look at the map, you see that to the east you've got the Medes, and they're off the map. But if you went a bit further east, then you'd be into the territory of the Persians. So the history is a little bit complex. And the Medes were at one point allies with the Babylonians to overthrow the Assyrians, but now the Medes ally themselves with the Persians, and Cyrus is king of the Medes and the Persians, and he captures Babylon, and in a night the Babylonian Empire is overthrown, just as Isaiah had promised. And wanting to win friends and influence people, Cyrus issues an edict allowing exiled peoples, including the Jews, to return to their homelands. And so there's an edict that we have recorded in the book of Ezra, an edict of Cyrus that allows the Jews to go home from Babylon to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. And for a long time, the unbelieving secular historian said, well, no great king of the ancient world would have done that. He just wouldn't have done it, because why would he let these captive peoples go? Why would he let his slaves go? Why would he let the workforce go? Why would he let them go back home? And so they said, the Bible account, well, it can't be true. Could never have happened. Until someone dug up a clay cylinder. And I've put you a picture of it. You can go and see it in the British Museum. But since we can't pop up to the British Museum tonight, you can look at the picture. And that is known as the Cyrus cylinder. And the covered in markings, which are cuneiform writing. And there are very clever people who can decipher such things and tell us what it says. And essentially it's an account of the conquest of Babylon by Cyrus in 539 BC. And of his restoration of various temples. Now, if you look at what it says in the box, this is Cyrus begins to speak for himself. And he says, as for the population of Babylon, who, as if without divine intervention, had endured a yoke not decreed for them, I soothed their weariness, I freed them from their bonds. All kings who sit on thrones from every quarter, from the upper sea to the lower sea, those who inhabit remote districts, and the kings of the land of the Amaru who live in tents, all of them brought their weighty tribute into Shurana and kissed my feet. From Shurana I sent back to their places, to the city of Ashur and Susa, Akkad, the land of Eshuna, the city of Zamban, the city of Menturna, Dur, all these places you are very familiar with, I'm sure. As far as the border of the land of Kutu, the sanctuaries across the river Tigris, whose shrines had earlier become dilapidated, the gods who lived therein, and made permanent sanctuaries for them. I collected together all their people and returned them to their settlements. And the gods of the land of Sumer and Akkad, which Nabonidus, to the fury of the Lord of the gods, had brought into Shurana at the command of Marduk, the great lord, I returned them unharmed to their cells in the sanctuaries to make them happy. So he says, I did send them home. I did send these peoples captive in Babylon back to their homelands, back, and I sent their gods back to their various temples and shrines so the gods would be happy back where they belonged, and the peoples would be happy back where they belong. Which is exactly what the biblical account said he did do for the Jewish people.
So he was a king as well.
Yeah. So Cyrus, this is Cyrus the Great, he's the king of the Persians, and he's ruling over the Medes as well. There's this sort of Medo-Persian alliance, and that he captures the city of Babylon, overthrows the Babylonian regime, and basically takes over all the Babylonian territory and establishes what we now know of as the Persian Empire, which stretched from northern India to Greece. This huge empire. And so he now has under his power, under his rule, all these various captive peoples who've been taken from their homelands and taken to Babylon. And he's boasting here how he pleased the gods by sending them back home to their homelands to rebuild their temples. So in slightly perhaps easier to understand form, let's just, are we coming? Yeah, we've got time. If you can find Ezra. So if you go after Kings, if you just run through 1 and 2 Chronicles. And you come to Ezra. This says, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem, and may their God be with them. and in any locality where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with free will offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. And then the family heads of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. So some of those captive in Babylon head home to back to the land, back to Judah, back to Jerusalem, to the ruined city, to rebuild it and rebuild the temple. There are three waves of return, three groups return. The first is under a guy called Zerubbabel. Of course, Zerubbabel, he's got an appropriate name, hasn't he? Remember that Zerubbabel goes out to sort out the rubble, yeah? Okay, so Zerubbabel, and guess what? Zerubbabel is the descendant of David. He is the man who would be king if the Persians permitted them to have a king. He's the heir to the Davidic throne, and he's the first guy to go back leading a group to return to Jerusalem, and he can't be king, he is governor. He's appointed by the Persians as governor. And then some years later, Ezra goes back with another group. And some years after that, Nehemiah goes back with another group. So there are three waves of return, just as in fact there have been three waves of exile to Babylon before the end. And so eventually a sort of autonomous state within the Persian Empire is established, and Jerusalem is rebuilt, and the temple is rebuilt, and God has preserved his people, and he keeps preserving his people. And the story of Esther is another story of how, during the time of the Persians, when the whole Jewish people are threatened with being wiped out, God works through Esther to preserve them. God's keeping his people. But you see, the thing is this. When compared to the promise of the prophets about the restoration, this return back is really a great disappointment. So those who remember, so they rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, but those who remember Solomon's temple don't reckon the new temple's up to much. And this little band of returnees around Jerusalem has some pretty hostile neighbours. And they're still living under foreign rule, Persian overlords and then Greek overlords. And their initial intentions to obey God's law soon seem to evaporate, and the same old problems of sinful disobedience re-emerge. And to cap it all, they don't have a Davidic king reigning over them to secure justice and peace for them. Yes, David's family line has been preserved, but none of them reign as king. And the prophets of this time, there are three what we call post-exilic prophets, three prophets who preach their message after the exile, after the return from exile, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And they make it plain, they're the final prophets of the Old Testament, and they make it plain that the kingdom of God is yet to come. And they rebuke the people for their sin and encourage them with assurances that the real glory is yet to come. God's word has not failed. He's still at work, and the fulfillment of his promises will come. And the Old Testament closes with the words of these prophets around about the end of the 5th century BC, so 400 and something, with the people then waiting and waiting down through the centuries for the promises to be fulfilled. And the last thing I want to do with you is just my home and away diagram, which I got from somebody else. But I think it's rather good. Home. Away. So, when it all starts out, who are God's people? Back in Genesis 1, 2? Adam and Eve. Where are they? In Eden. Do you think Eden is home or away?
Home.
then what happens? They sin, and they are kicked out of the garden to live east of Eden. So do you think they're home or away?
Okay.
They're away. Living east of Eden. The turning point comes with Abraham. I'll put him over here already. But so where does he start off? Away.
In Ur.
In Ur, and then moving to Haran, but still away. But God says, go to the land I will show you. And where does he travel to?
Canaan.
Now, is Canaan home or away?
Home.
So Abraham goes from being away to Canaan, the promised land. And his descendants live in Canaan for a while. But then what happens?
Egypt.
Yeah, they go to, through Joseph and all of that, they end up going to Egypt, which is that home or away?
Away.
That's away. So they're living in Egypt. And then, so they're in Egypt for quite a long time, until God does what?
Exodus.
The Exodus. Through Moses, raised up Moses to rescue them from Egypt, and they sort of start travelling in the right direction, and then they sort of wander around for a little bit. But eventually, after they're wandering around under Joshua, they end up going where? Back to Canaan, back home, to where they should be. So then we get... They're living in the land. We go through the period of the judges. We get Saul as the first king, and then we get David as king, and then David's son Solomon. And then, of course, after Solomon comes the division of the kingdom. So now we've got two lines. But they're still living in... This line's in the south of Canaan. This line is in the north of Canaan. Until we come to... Well, what happens to this northern kingdom? Assyrian exile. So... They are away, and they just go off the page. So that's the Assyrian exile. This line continues for a bit longer until what happens to them? Exile. And where do they go?
Babylon.
But rather than being scattered to all sorts of places like this lot with the Assyrian exile, the Jews from Judah, well, they're sort of held as one group in Babylon. They're split a bit. You've got the elite in the city itself, and you've got the hoi polloi living outside on the plains outside of Babylon, but they're all there in Babylon, which means they can come home. And so that's what we just talked about. Some period of exile, the captivity in Babylon. Jeremiah had said it'd be 70 years, and then they come back to the land. So one way to view the biblical history is this all this home away stuff. Out of God's presence, back to the land, away from the land, back into the land of God's presence, exiled from God's presence, exiled from God's presence, brought back. Back, perhaps not what we say the focus of that return is, it's the return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple so that they might live with God in their presence, in their midst, God present with them at the temple in Jerusalem. But as I said, this return really all in the end, a big disappointment. And we close the Old Testament waiting for the true kingdom to come, which will be our subject next week.
So it doesn't, further on, we don't need to know. specifically, or maybe it does tell us specifically who the descendants of David are.
Yeah, well, they're very careful with their records, so they know exactly who the... So with Ezra, yes. So, yeah, they're careful, so they know... So, you know, you get the lists in Ezra and also in Chronicles, you get these lists of the people who returned, and it's very important that they know what family they belong to. So that when we come into the New Testament, and we start, say, in Matthew's Gospel, it starts with the genealogy that leads to Jesus.
Yeah.
They know the line of descent, and it can be traced. So if you just look at it now. If you look at Matthew chapter 1, You see that? So we go from Abraham to David at verse 6, and then David was the father of Solomon and so on. Then there'll be a number of names, some of which are familiar, so you'll see Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah there in verse 10, the father of Manasseh that we've mentioned and so on, up to Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon, verse 11. Then after the exile, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel. He's the guy who leads the first group of returnees from exile. He's the father of Abihud, Abihud the father of Eliakim, and so on, leading us to Joseph, the husband of Mary, the mother of Jesus, who's called the Messiah. So yeah, the line of descent from David can still can be traced after the exile. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean you don't have to sort of keep in your head everything that I've said tonight. Keeping the broad outline of what happens is helpful. I've tried to add in some of the colour.
The cylinder, was there something that was found as a historical?
A sort of bit of archaeology of actually digging it up out of the ground, and they find it. The people like the Babylonians and the Persians were very into recording the history on these things and actually burying them in the foundations of temples and cities and so on. So there will be a record. It would not be lost what had been done.
When was that found?
Sometime 19th century, I think. But you can look it up on the British Museum website. I didn't have time for all.
It lasted that long.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, clay. Yeah, so it's the benefit of the extremely dry conditions that exist in the Middle East that these things are preserved. Yeah. There's a lovely one about Belshazzar's feast. Yeah, in the Book of Daniel. So Belshazzar, king of Babylon, and there's the finger. So he sees a finger writing on the wall. What is it? Tekel, tekel, many tekel, tekel. Yeah. And he's terrified by what this omen means. And Daniel is hauled in, old man at this point, to interpret it. It says basically says you've been weighed and found wanting, and your kingdom will fall this very night. And the secular historian said, well, it's all made up because there was no Belshazzar. There is no record of a Belshazzar, king of Babylon. It's a mythical thing. The king was Nabonidus. No record of Belshazzar. And then I think maybe in somewhere like that, of all places, they're excavating a temple to the moon god that had been built by Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus. And in the under the foundation of one of the corners of this temple, they find this clay cylinder, which refers to Belshazzar. So they're buried under the corner of a temple to a moon god. There's the archaeological evidence for the existence of Belshazzar, who did reign as a regent. While Nabonidus was busy going around building temples and things, Belshazzar was actually left in Babylon to actually do the ruling and reigning. So that's happened sort of time and time and time again, that the things that people have said it's only found in the Bible, so it can't be true, and then lo and behold, a little while later, the archaeology turns up and vindicates what the Bible's been saying all along.
So is there a whole section then in the British Museum about things from the Bible?
No, they don't put it all together, because it's sort of done in terms of historical periods and so on, so the Assyrian sections and so on. So you have to, there is a book that you can get, a guide to the Bible stuff in the museum, that's published by a Christian publisher called Day One. Brian Edwards and Clive Anderson and so on. So yeah, and you can go and do, I mean, they do tours and other people do as well. We take the students from the training course on a tour. So it helps to have someone to take you around and actually point out the Bible stuff.
So the museum doesn't do the tours?
No, but...
Interesting to do.
Lots of people do go in taking groups around on tours. Yeah. It's very interesting. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's just another 450 years of history. Okay. Right, let's pray.